Craig picked up Sally Ann from the hospital the following morning. She wore the same jeans, shirt and trainers as she had when she was admitted. "Sister had them washed and mended." She stopped and she saw the Land Rover. "What's this? I thought we were broke." "The computer hasn't had the happy news yet. They're all still honouring my American Express card."
"Is that kosher?"
"When you owe 5 big M's, lady, another couple of $100 sits pretty lightly on the conscience." He grinned at her as he turned the ignition key, and when the engine fired, he said cheerfully, "Eat your heart out, Mr. Hertz."
"You're taking it very well, Craig."
She slid across the seat closer to him. "We're both alive. That is cause for fireworks and general rejoicing. As for the money, well, I don't think I was truly cut out to be a millionaire. When I've got money, I spend all my time worrying about losing it. It saps my energy. Now that I've lost it, I feel free again in a funny sort of way."
"You happy to have lost everything you ever owned?"
She turned sideways in the seat to look at him.
"Even for you, that's cuckoo."
"I'm not happy, no," he denied the charge. "What I truly regret is losing King's Lynn and Zambezi Waters. We could have made something wonderful out of them, you and I. I regret that very much. And I regret Tungata Zabiwe."
"Yes,
we destroyed him." Both of them were sobered and saddened. If there was only something we could do for him. "Not a damn thing," Craig shook his head. "Despite Timon's assurances, we don't know that he is still alive, and even if he is, we don't have the faintest idea where he is or how to find him." They rattled across the railway lines and into the main street of Francistown. "Jewel of the North," said Craig. "Population 2,000, main industry, consumption of alcoholic beverage, reason for existing, uncertain." They parked outside the single hotel. "As you can see, total population now in permanent residence in the public bar." However, the young Botswana receptionist was pretty and efficient. "Mr. Mello, there is a lady waiting to see you," she called, as Craig entered the lobby. Craig did not recognize his visitor, not until Sally Ann ran forward to embrace her.
"Sarah," she cried, "how did you get here? How did you find us?"
Craig's room had 2 single beds with a dressing table between them, a threadbare imitation Persian rug on the shiny red-painted cement floor, and a single wooden chair. The 2 girls sat on one bed with their legs curled up under them in that double-jointed feminine attitude.
"They told me at the Red Cross that you had been found in the desert and brought in by the police, Miss J."
"My name is Sally Ann, Sarah."
Sarah smiled softly in acknowledgement.
"I wasn't sure if you would want to see me again, not after the trial. But then my friends here told me how you had been ill-treated by Funga Bearer's soldiers. I thought you might have realized that I was right all along, that Tungata Zabiwe was not a criminal, and that he needs friends now."
She turned towards Craig.
"He was your friend, Mr. Mello. He told me about you. He spoke of you with respect and great feeling. He was afraid for you when he heard that you had returned to Zimbabwe. He realized that you wanted to take up your family land in Matabele land, and he knew there was going to be terrible troubles and that you would be caught up in them. He said that you were too gentle for the hard times that were coming. He called you Pufo, the dreamer, the gentle dreamer. But he said that you are also stubborn and obstinate. He wanted to save you from being hurt again. He said last time he lost his leg, this time he could lose his life. To be his friend, I must make him and myself his enemy. I must drive him out of Zimbabwe."
Craig sat in the straight-backed wooden chair and remembered his stormy meeting with Tungata when he had come to him for assistance in acquiring King's Lynn.
Had it been an act, then?
Even now he found that hard to believe. Tungata's passion had been so real, his fury so convincing.
"I am sorry, Mr. Mello. These are very rude things that I am saying about you. I am telling you only what Tungata said. He was your friend. He still is your friend."
"Doesn't really matter any more what he thought of me," Craig murmured. "Sam's probably dead by now."
"No."
For the first time, Sarah raised her voice, her tone vehement, almost angry.
"No, do not say that. Never say that. He is alive. I have seen and spoken to him. They can never kill a man like that.
The chair creaked under Craig as he leaned forward eagerly.
You've seen him?
When?
2 weeks ago.
Where?
Where was he?
Tutti. At the camp.
Sam. Alive.
Craig changed as he said it. The despondent slump of his shoulders squared out. He held his head at a more alert angle, and his eyes were brighter, more eager. He wasn't really looking at Sarah. He was looking at the wall above her head, trying to marshal the torrent of emotions and ideas that came at him, so he did not see that Sarah was weeping. It was Sally Ann who put a protective and comforting arm about her, and Sarah sobbed,
"Oh, my Lord Tungata, the things they have done to him! They have starved and beaten him. He is like a village cur, all bones and scars. He walks like a very, very old man. Only his eyes are still proud."
Sally Ann hugged her wordlessly. Craig jumped up from the chair and began to pace. The room was so small he crossed it in 4 strides, turned and came back. Sally Ann dug in her pocket and found a crumpled tissue for Sarah.
"When will the Cessna be ready?" Craig asked, without pausing in his stride. His artificial leg made a tiny click each time he swung it forward.
"It's been ready since last week."
"I told you, didn't I?"
Sally Ann replied distractedly, fussing over Sarah.
"And what is her all-up capacity?"
"The Cessna?
I've had 6 adults in her, but that was a squeeze. She's licensed for—"
Sally Ann stopped. Slowly her head turned from Sarah towards him, and she stared at him in total disbelief.
"In the love of all that's holy, Craig, are you out of your mind?"
"Range fully loaded?"
Craig ignored the question.
1,200 nautical miles, throttle setting for maximum endurance. "But you can't be serious."
"Okay," Craig was thinking aloud. "I can get a couple of drums in the Land Rover. You can land and refuel on a pan right on the border. I know a spot near Panda Matenga, 500 kilometers north of here. That is the closest point of entry."
"Craig, do you know what they'd do if they caught us?" Sally Ann's voice was husky with shock.
Sarah had the tissue over her nose, but her eyes swiveled between the two of them as they spoke.
"Weapons," Craig muttered. "We need arms. Morgan Oxford?
No, damn it, he's written us off."
"Guns!"
Sarah's voice was muffled by tears and tissue.
"Guns and grenades," Craig agreed. "Explosives, whatever we can get." "I can get guns. Some of our people have escaped. They are here in Botswana. They have guns hidden in the bush from the war."
"What kind?" Craig demanded. "Banana guns and hand grenades."
"AKs," Craig rejoiced. "Sarah, you're a star." "Just the two of us?"
Sally Ann paled as she realized that he truly meant it.
"Two of us against the entire 3rd Brigade? Is that what you're thinking about?" "No, no. I am coming with you."
Sarah put aside the tissue.
"There will be 3 of us." "3 of us? Great,"
said Sally Ann.
"3 of us? Bloody marvelous."
Craig came back and stood in front of them.
"Number 1, we are going to draw up a map of Tutti Camp. We're going to put down every detail we can remember."
He started pacing again, unable to stand still.
"Number 2, we meet with Sarah's friends and see how much help they can give us. Number 3, Sally Ann takes the commercial flight down to Johannesburg and brings back the Cessna. How long will that take?"
"I can be back in 3 days."
Colour was coming back into Sally Ann's cheeks.
"That's if I decide to go."
"Okay, fine."
Craig rubbed his hands together. "Now we can start on the map." Craig ordered sandwiches and a bottle of wine sent to the room, and they worked through until 2 a.m, when Sarah left them with a promise to return at breakfast time. Craig folded the map carefully, and then he and Sally Ann climbed into one of the narrow beds together. But they were so keyed up that neither of them could sleep.
"Sam was trying to protect me," Craig marvelled. "He was doing it for me all along."
"Tell me about him," Sally Ann whispered, and she lay against his chest and listened to him talk of their friendship. When at last he fell silent, she asked softly,
"So you are serious about this thing?" deadly serious. But will you do it with me? It's crazy, she said. It's plain dumb. But let's do it then.
The sooty black smoke from the beacon fires of oily rags that Craig had set climbed straight up in two columns into the clear desert sky. Craig and Sarah stood together on the bonnet of the Land Rover, staring into the south. This was the dry, wild land of northeastern Botswana. The Zimbabwe border was 30 kilometres east of them. The flat, arid plain between, pimpled with camel-thorn trees and blotched with the leprous white salt pans. The mirage shimmered and tricked the eye so that the stunted trees on the far side of the pan seemed to swim and change shape like dark amoeba under a microscope. A spinning dust devil jumped up from the white pan surface and swirled and swayed sinuously as a belly dancer, rising 200 feet into the hot air until it collapsed again as suddenly as it had risen. The sound of the Cessna engine rose and fell and rose again on the heat-floored air.
There! Sarah pointed out the mosquito speck low on the horizon.
Craig made a last anxious appraisal of his makeshift landing strip. He had lit the beacon fires at each end of it as soon as they had picked up the first throb of the Cessna's motor. He had driven the Land Rover back and forth between the beacons to mark the hard crust at the edge of the pan. 50 metres out, the surface was treacherously soft. Now he looked back at the approaching aircraft. Sally Ann was banking low over the baobab trees, lining up with the strip he had set out for her. She made a prudent, precautionary pass along it, her head twisted in the cockpit window as she examined it. Then she came around again and touched down lightly and taxied towards the Land Rover.
"You were gone forever," Craig seized her as she jumped down from the cockpit.
3 days, she protested, with her feet off the ground.
"That's forever," he said, and kissed her.
He set her down, but kept one arm around her as he led her to the Land Rover. After she had greeted Sarah, Craig introduced her to the two Matabele who were squatting in the shade of the Land Rover. They rose courteously to meet her.
"This is Jonas, and this is Aaron. They led us to the arms cache, and they are giving us all the help they can."
They were reserved and unsmiling young men with old eyes that had seen unspeakable things, but they were willing and quick. They pumped the AV gas from the 44-gallon drums on the back of the Land Rover directly into the Cessna's wing tanks, while Craig stripped out the seats from the rear of the cockpit to reduce weight and give them cargo space. Then they began loading. Sally Ann weighed each item of cargo on the spring balance that she had bought for the purpose and entered it on her loading table. The ammunition was the heaviest part of the load. They had 8,000 rounds of 7.62mm ball peas. Craig had broken bulk and repacked it in black plastic garbage bags to save weight and space. It had been buried for years, and many of the rounds were so corroded as to be useless. However, Craig had hand-sorted it and test-fired a few rounds from each case without a single misfire. Most of the rifles had also been corroded, and Craig had worked through the nights by gas lantern, stripping and cannibalizing, until he had 25 good weapons. There were also 5 Tokarev pistols and 2 cases of fragmentation grenades, which seemed in better condition than the rifles. Craig had set off 1 grenade from each case, popping them down an ant-bear hole to a satisfactory crump and cloud of dust. That had left 48 from the original 50. Craig packed them in 5 cheap canvas haversacks that he had bought from a general dealer in Francistown. The rest of the equipment he had also purchased in Francistown. Wire cutters and bolt cutters, nylon ropes, pangas that Jonas and Aaron sharpened to razor edges, flashlights and extra batteries, canteens and water bottles, and a dozen or so other items which might prove useful. Sarah had been appointed medical orderly, and had made up a first aid kit with items purchased at the Francistown pharmacy. The food rations were Spartan. Raw maize meal packed in 5-kilo plastic bags, the best nourishment-to-weight ratio available, and a few bags of coarse salt.
"Okay, that's it," Sally Ann called a halt to the loading. "Another ounce and we won't get off the ground. The rest of it'll have to wait for a second trip."
When darkness fell, They sat around the campfire and gorged on the steaks and fresh fruit that Sally Ann had brought with her from Johannesburg.
"Eat hearty, my children," she encouraged them. "It could be a long time."
Afterwards, Craig and Sally Ann carried their blankets away from the fire, out of earshot of the others, and they lay naked in the warm desert air and made love under the silver sickle of the moon, both of them poignantly aware that it might be for the last time. They ate breakfast in the dark, after the moon had set, and before the first glimmering of the dawn. They left Jonas and Aaron to guard the Land Rover and help with loading and refueling for the second trip, and Sally Ann taxied out to the end of the strip when it was just light enough to make out the tracks. Even in the cool of night, it took the overloaded Cessna forever to unstick, and they climbed away slowly towards the glow of the sunrise.
"Zimbabwe border," Sally Ann murmured, "and I still can't believe what we're doing."
Craig was perched up beside her on the bags of ammunition, while Sarah was curled up like a salted anchovy on top of the load behind them. Sally Ann banked slightly as she picked up her landmarks from the map on her lap. She had laid out a course to cross the railway line 15 miles south of the coal mining town of Wanki, and then to cross the main road a few miles beyond, avoiding all human habitation. The terrain below them changed swiftly, the desert falling away and becoming densely forested with open glades of golden grass. There was some high, fair-weather cumulus in the north. Otherwise, the sky was clear. Craig squinted ahead down the track of the rising sun.
"There's the railway."
Sally Ann closed the throttle, and they descended sharply. 50 feet above the treetops, they roared over the deserted railway tracks, and minutes later crossed the main road. They had a glimpse of a truck crawling along the blue-grey tarmac ribbon, but they crossed behind it and were visible to it for only seconds. Sally Ann pulled a face.
"Let's hope they make nothing of us. There must be quite a bit of light aircraft traffic around here."
She glanced at her wristwatch.
"Expected time of arrival, 40 minutes.
"All right," Craig said. "Let's get over it one more time. You drop Sarah and me, then clear out again as quickly as possible, back to the pan. Reload and refuel. 2 days from now, you come back. If there is a smoke signal, you land. No signal, and you head back to the pan. Give it 2 more days, and then the last trip. If there's no smoke signal on the second trip, that's it. You head out, and you don't come back."
She reached out and took his hand. "Craig, don't even say that. Please, darling, come back to me."
They held hands for the rest of the trip, except for the brief moments when she needed both for the controls. "There it is." The Chazarira River was a dark green python across the vast brown land, and there was a glint of water through the trees.
"Zambezi waters, just up there."
They were keeping well clear of the camps that they had built with so much loving labour, but both of them stared longingly upstream to where the dreaming blue hills studded the line of the horizon. Sally Ann dropped lower and still lower until she was shaving the treetops, and then she turned slowly back in a wide circle, keeping the hills between them and the buildings on Zambezi waters.
"There it is," Craig called, and pointed out under the port wingtip, and they had a glimpse of white beads at the edge of the trees. "They're still there."
The bones of Craig's poached rhinoceros had been picked over by the scavengers and bleached by the sun. Sally Ann ran her landing check and then lined up for the narrow strip of grassland along the head of the gorge where she had landed before.
"Just pray the warthog and ant bear haven't been digging around," she murmured,
and the overloaded Cessna wallowed sluggishly, and the stall warning bleeped and flashed intermittently at the reduced power setting. Sally Ann dropped in steeply over the treetops and touched down with a jarring thud. The Cessna pitched and bounced over the rough ground, but maximum safe braking and the coarse grass wrapping the undercarriage pulled them up quickly, and Sally Ann let out her breath.
"Thank you, Lord."
They offloaded with frenzied haste, piling everything in a heap and spreading over it the green nylon nets designed for shading young plants from the sun that Craig had found in Francistown. Then Sally Ann and Craig looked at each other miserably.
"Oh, God, I hate this," she said. Me too, so go, 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 quickly, damn it.
They kissed, and she broke away and ran back to the cockpit. She taxied to the end of the clearing, flattening the grass, and then came back at full throttle in her own tracks. The lightened aircraft leapt into the air, and the last he saw of her was her pale face in the side window, turning back towards him, and then the treetops cut them off from each other. Craig waited until the last vibration of the engine died away, and the silence of the bush closed in again. Then he picked up the rifle and haversack and slung them over his shoulders. He looked at Sarah. She wore denims and blue canvas shoes. She carried the food bag and water bottles, with the Tukharev holstered on her belt.
Ready?
She nodded, fell in behind him, and stayed with the forcing pace he set. They reached the koppie in the early part of the afternoon, and from the summit Craig looked towards the camps of Zambezi waters on the river. This would be the dangerous part now. But he lit the signal fire, and then, taking Sarah with him, moved out and set up an ambush on the approach path, just in case the smoke signal brought unwanted visitors. He and Sarah lay up in good cover, and neither of them moved nor spoke for 3 hours. Only their eyes were busy, sweeping the slopes below and above, and the bush all around. Even so, they were taken unawares. The voice was a harsh, raw whisper in Sindibele, close, very close by.
Ha! Kufela! So you have brought my money!
Comrade Lookout's scarred visage peered at them. He had crept up to within 10 paces without alerting them.
I thought you had forgotten us.
No money for you, but hard and dangerous work, Craig told him.
There were 3 men with Comrade Lookout, lean, wolf-like men. They extinguished the signal fire and then spread back into the bush in an extended scouting order that would cover their march.
We must go, Comrade Lookout explained. Here in the open, the Shona Kanka press us like hunting dogs. Since we last met, we have lost many good men. Comrade Dollar has been taken by them.
Yes, Craig remembered him, beaten and bedraggled, giving evidence against him on that terrible night at King's Lynn.
They marched until 2 hours after darkness, northwards into the bad and broken land along the escarpment of the great river. The way was cleared for them and guarded by the scouts, who were always invisible in the forest ahead. Only their bird calls guided and reassured them. They came at last to the guerrilla camp. There were women at the small smokeless cooking fires, and one of them ran to embrace Sarah as soon as she recognized her.
She is my aunt's youngest daughter,
Sarah explained. She and Craig spoke only Sindibele to each other now.